Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for staying on for the panel and debate. We're going to be looking at, is tax avoidance the greatest barrier to a fairer society? We're actually going to kick off, though, with just chatting to Caroline and Omar a little bit about the show. And I'm really interested to know the inspiration behind it. I know that many artists wouldn't really want to engage with the issue of tax, based on what generally happens around tax return day and filling in forms and the way I know that I don't like filling in my tax return and things like that. So I just wondered what inspired you both to want to work on this piece.
Shall I start?
Okay, I'll start. I suppose, like a lot of people, after the 2008 crisis, I felt very frustrated that I didn't seem to understand exactly what had gone wrong. So I started reading all those sort of books that were suddenly appearing, the sort of by John Lanchester and Mike Lewis about, you know, they're called whoops or various things that sound like whoops. They are brilliant. But even with those, I felt the stuff slipping from my head. And I suppose as I read more about it, the element of it that really caught my attention was tax havens, because I knew about them and sort of thought they were benign things that very wealthy individuals or multinationals used to save themselves a bit of money, and I didn't think they did any damage particularly. And so it was that as I read more about it and realized quite how toxic, I suppose, they are, and how the massive problems they cause. I just couldn't believe that it wasn't more common knowledge. And then, of course, gradually over the few years after that, it's become more and more headline news. But I suppose it just feels like a problem that we don't quite know how to solve yet. And that was how my attention got caught. And the specific thing, I suppose, both in the making of Islands and then in this little new project that some of you have just witnessed, the thing that really interested me was how clean the image is somehow, because it all happens in multinationals and nice office blocks, and the government is very supportive of big business, and it all seems ever so establishment and official, and actually I find it really repellent, and I suppose it was, and violent on some level. So I suppose I wanted to see if I could connect that feeling with the world of tax. So that's why the world we created is so filthy and it's violent, and yeah, so that's where it came from. But maybe Omar is more coherent.
Yeah, so Caroline was already working on this idea and project when she spoke to me about it. And I guess we had already worked together before, but I think we found common ground in terms of the level of indignation that we had towards not only the subject of tax havens, but inequality in general. And I guess because of our training as theater makers, we both trained in France. We both explored the style of grotesque theater and Buffon. So there was a very clear idea from the very beginning not to try and do a well-written, well-made play that wanted to spit out statistics and numbers and try to analyze the subject from a objective point of view, but actually to try and associate something like Caroline described that feels very distant and very sanitized and very in the statistical world to images that were a bit more shocking and that would shake us literally in our seats. I was just thinking, actually, a couple of days ago, you probably all seen the shocking images coming from Greece or southern Italy or Austria of the migrants drowned or asphyxiated in lorries. And of course, these kind of shake our consciousness and our consciences, but we don't have the same thing for tax havens. But actually, the byproduct of tax evasion and capital flight from third world countries is exactly the same, and that's why we wanted to associate, I guess, blood and shit and something extremely filthy with this subject. So I guess that's where it clicked, and it was a really interesting journey for us, because in one way, the most interesting responses to the work came from people who work or have worked or have been exposed from the inside to these environments, saying how actually the reality that we were depicting on stage was not that far away from their own experience. And sometimes reality can even surpass the grotesque imagination of us poor theater makers trying to make sense of it all. So I guess that's where the spark came from, and of course being able to share it with many people, you get so many different responses, not all positive, of course, but I think that's where we understood we were kind of rubbing in the right wound and the right hiatus. So yeah.
And what about the religious imagery that you use in the show? I'm just wondering why you chose to kind of contextualize it in that way.
I suppose we were thinking of these modern day gods who make the rules somehow, big business, or, you know, the sparkly temple that is the city of London. So it felt like, and we were working the whole thing, both islands and this little version, work in massively broad, sweeping images and metaphors and big, ugly brushstrokes. So for us, this was the little pattern of a story that we could take and say, these are our modern false gods, and we need to rip them down, I suppose, was the very basic idea. And so then with that as like a loose backdrop, we could then play within that structure. So I suppose that's where it came from.
It felt very important, I guess, to lean on something that was of shared knowledge. And I think the myth of creation and the idea of faith as something that in some contexts you do not question and is given, to us felt like a really strong structure to be able to rely on. So the idea that a lot of the time you hear people articulating the point of view for which they say, well, this is how the world works. We can't just go and dismantle it. But actually being able to question that very idea, relying on this idea of the story and where the story comes from, for us made it easier rather than inventing a whole new set of allegories and myths and ideas. And it also kind of, I think, affected the way our research in the epicness of the language. I think, Caroline, you borrowed a lot, not only from the Bible, but from Conrad, Greek mythology. So that kind of language felt really important, and that kind of link felt really important to make it bigger than just the mundane, oh, it's about office workers in a cubicle somewhere in the city of London or on Jersey.
Yeah, it certainly provided a different perspective. So it sort of shifted it around and made me look at it in a new way. I really enjoyed that. So we're going to just move on to start the debate, really, around tax avoidance. And Mike Truman is just going to help us understand some of the language that we use around that, and then the others will respond.
Omar said already that, that deliberately this isn't a sort of a piece where you put together statistics and facts and things, and quite right, because otherwise it wouldn't keep you as gripped as that 40 minutes did, and the danger is that I'm about to put you all to sleep. But Most people probably in this room make charitable donations, because I mean that's the sort of thing that Greenbelt is. Can I do the bit? Greenbelt Angels, please. Angels? Yeah, great, fantastic. If you're not an angel, do please go and talk to one of the people who were angels. There's the venue manager's bit done. You'll make charitable donations. Very few people overpay their taxes. Occasionally people do, and apparently you get a very nice letter from the Treasury if you pay more than you're due in tax. And the point I'm making is that, therefore, taxes by rules. But we won't overpay our taxes because we think if the government would only spend them on the things that I think they should be spent on, then I would pay more, but because they don't, I won't. So taxes are a rule-based system. And in terms of language, tax compliance is one of the bits that we tend to all agree on. That's making sure that, you know, your tax return goes in, that the revenue have asked for the right amount of tax compared to what you've said, that you've paid the right amount of tax, that you paid it at the right time, and so on. Tax evasion is right over the other end, and that is about deliberately breaking the law, deliberately hiding money from the revenue, deliberately telling them that you have less income than you actually have, not paying the tax on it. There is absolutely no... I'm not saying that there aren't people in tax havens who do collude in tax evasion. It has happened. It probably still does happen. But it's certainly not something that any big accountancy firm would help you with. In the middle is where we get the sort of the disputes, and the language then tends to get complicated, and it's a matter of where we want to put it. But let's say, for example, tax planning tends to be what people say when you do something that is a relief or a way to reduce your tax bill that the government wants you to do, and you do it that way. So everybody who filled in the gift aid form at the communion yesterday, that's tax planning. Greenbelt has got more money because of a relief that you're meant to use. Then you get into, well, it's a relief that's meant to be there, but you're using it in a different way. Or there are different ways that you could do this transaction, and you have deliberately chosen the one that gives you the least tax. And that, I mean, it's arguable as to whether that's tax avoidance or tax planning, and that's where we all start arguing. Then you get into aggressive tax avoidance, which is where you're doing something that has absolutely no commercial reason whatsoever, but you're doing it purely because it gives you a tax reduction. And that's the area where most of these schemes and things are at the moment. I have to say there is a much, much lower desire to get into aggressive tax avoidance now than I have ever seen. And that is the result of the tax justice campaigning. I've got some issues about the way that's been done, which we'll probably come back to. But it definitely has had the effect that particularly large multinationals do not want to go anywhere near aggressive tax avoidance anymore. Yes, they will plan their affairs in a way that gives them the lowest tax bill, but they will not get involved in completely non-commercial aggressive tax avoidance anymore.
David, would you like to respond to Mike?
Well, yes, let me say first that I got into this whole area by reading a book called Treasure Islands by Nicholas Shackson, which I would still recommend very strongly to people if you really want to get angry about tax avoidance, evasion. I just use the word dodging because I think there is a spectrum, as Mike indicated, and it's a desire not to pay your tax. And what Nick Shackson does is to paint the picture of this new country which is up there. It's called offshore, and that's where rich people and large multinational companies put their money in order that they can avoid, obey, dodge tax. I would take a bit of issue with Mike about his use of tax planning. I don't think charitable donations are tax planning at all, because I think you would make your donations to Greenbelt, I hope, whether you were getting tax back on it or not, as most people would to charities. Maybe you give a little bit more because you're getting some of your tax back for the body. But tax planning is much more about how you seek to minimize your tax by playing around with the rules. And the rules, of course, are largely produced by governments, by the Treasury, which has the assistance, of course, of the tax accountants of PricewaterhouseCoopers and Deloitte and those other rascals who manipulate the system in order that the rich companies and individuals might dodge their taxes. So we have a whole system here which is going to be pretty hard to break, and there are ways of doing it, and we've evolved some. Maybe Alistair will talk a bit more about that from Christian Aid, because they've done a lot of the work in this. I would just want to add one other small thing which occurred to me as Omar was talking about what's going on in Europe, in Southern Europe at the present time, because very fortunately, I and my family were on a Greek island last week having a holiday, special holiday for particular reasons. I have to say the weather was a great deal better than it is here. But there on that small Greek island, the dinghies with the Syrian refugees from Turkey were finding it very difficult to get into the harbours on the Greek islands, because there are swarms, I use my language very carefully, of super yachts, which the super rich now inhabit all over the place, and it just demonstrated what vast wealth there is available if we can tap into it and actually use it for, I think, the means which God created. So those are some of my background thoughts.
Thank you, David. Alistair, would you like to speak to Mike and what he said?
So, sort of, I've known Mike for a good amount of time now. We see each other generally each year at Greenbelt. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be a JCB driver. I didn't think I would end up reading Taxation magazine as part of my career move. But over the last 7 years or so, Christian Aid's been campaigning for tax justice. And the reason why we've been doing it and been doing it for so long is tax has the potential to really transform the world, to transform the lives of thousands, millions of people all over, and that's for four real reasons. The first of all, first reason is that tax provides revenue. Now, revenue is critical for sort of building the infrastructure that's needed to support communities, whether that be schools and hospitals, whether that be roads, electricity, water, and sanitation. The second reason is that it's really important for redistribution, taking from those who can afford it and giving to those who are struggling the most. And that's really important. In a world where inequality is growing at rates that we've never seen before, that is absolutely critical. Thirdly, it's important in repricing, and that's where we see things like gift aid come in. Repricing is critical for making sure that we're encouraging good behavior and discouraging bad behavior. So, for example, gift aid, that's a sort of a tax relief that encourages good behavior that is morally the right thing to do. And the government wants us to do it. It encourages us to do it through gift aid. It also discourages the things that have a social cost to us as well. So the price on cigarettes, on alcohol, on fuel as well. Things that have a impact to our society and to our world, and that there's costs with that impact along the way. And then finally, and this one's probably the one which is perhaps got the least research around, but perhaps has the most hope for the world of why tax is really important, and that's representation. We know that when countries begin to take more taxes, citizens become more engaged in how those taxes are spent. It encourages democracy, it encourages communities and countries to thrive in a democratic way that can transform lives. Now, put those four together, and you've got something that can help transform the lives of the world's poorest. The challenge we have, and the bit where perhaps me and Mike begin to then disagree on stuff, is that at the moment we have this area that Mike really described very well, that we've got tax evasion, which we're very clear is illegal, we've got tax avoidance, which is legal, but I would say morally questionable. I really would say morally questionable. When I first started campaigning on tax 5 years ago with Christian Aid, someone said to me that the difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance is the width of a jail wall. It's a fine line between the two. And what we've had for too long is companies pushing those lines as far as they can. And that's not just an issue of accounting. That's not an issue of finances or economy. That's a moral issue because it has a moral impact. It has an impact on real people, real human beings. And that's why we need to get to grips with it. That's why we need to change the tax system so it works better for everyone, not just the rich.
Thank you, Alistair. So kind of, I guess, in response to that a little bit, there's been a lot in the news around sort of, I guess, tax avoidance in this country and, you know, in a time of austerity. So what about when companies, they use tax avoidance in other countries, in developing countries, and what exactly can be done about that? What needs to happen so that those companies who are taking the resources from some of the poorest countries in the world, how can we make them accountable for that?
Probably two key things, really. One is transparency. We need far greater financial transparency of the flows of money that are going around the world at the moment, because it's huge amounts. If we have that transparency, we have then the opportunity for greater accountability. Accountability of individuals, of accountancy firms, of companies as well. And that's really important. But secondly, there needs to be a behavioural change, an attitudinal change. It can't just be one of, we change the rules, we make things more transparent. We need to change the way we look at tax. I think that's come a long way in the last few years. I think that's actually been really encouraging. I think sort of soon after sort of Occupy, after the UK cut protests, one FTSE 100 listed company said to me, tax isn't something that's now the domain of our finance department. It's now something for our whole business plan. It's now a reputational risk. And for that company, that was a real shift for them at that time. They began to change their attitudes and views on how tax is used and wanted to start using it in different ways, not just trying to minimize a tax bill. And what we need is that to happen far more widely. We need to see that behavioral change. We need to see that greater engagement, not just by finance departments on tax, by whole companies and by whole society as well. But transparency needs to happen with that as well, and that involves changing rules.
This is where Alistair and I are in danger of agreeing far too much for making this anything interesting, but transparency, I think, absolutely is the key, and I don't think there is a great disagreement within a large part of the sensible tax side of the tax profession against transparency. Certainly if you go to the representative bodies, the sort of CIOT, ICAW, people like that, there is a great acceptance of the need for greater transparency. And indeed, it's part of our professional ethics. We are not meant as tax advisors to do anything which relies on it being secret. You're not meant to put one over the revenue by just keeping it secret. So that side of it, I think we agree on. Equally, I agree. I am dead against any form of what I refer to as aggressive tax avoidance, the sort of thing that has no commercial reality. Absolutely, that to me is not what we should be looking at. The difficulty comes when you are asking a company let's take Starbucks, because there's an example that gets looked at quite a lot. One interesting thing about Starbucks is that it's actually got quite a high tax rate. It pays, I think the last time I looked, its effective tax rate was something like 26%. Now, a large part of that is because America has quite a high corporate... Sorry, I will get terribly boring if I'm not careful. But America has quite a high tax rate on its own domestic profits. What it encourages is it encourages companies that operate multinationally not to remit that money to the US. I don't mean it encourages it deliberately. Well, it knows that the way that it set its structure up means that companies will keep the money outside the US. So they then set up a structure, and effectively they are always going to set up a structure that's going to result in them paying the less tax, because what level of tax do you expect them to create? And then if you've got something like Starbucks, the whole point about Starbucks is wherever you go in the world, You go to a Starbucks because it says Starbucks, or you don't go because it says Starbucks. But I mean, that's what attracts people. I don't know if anyone's ever been to Ramallah, but there is a place in Ramallah where the guy who runs this coffee shop was refused a franchise by Starbucks, so he set up something called Stars and Bucks, which looks exactly like Starbucks. It's fantastic. But I mean, the point is, he recognises the power of that brand. That there is a value to that brand therefore, if you set out, if you have a Starbucks coffee shop, it will pay a proportion of that money to the subsidiary of Starbucks that holds the brand. Any multinational company is probably going to put that subsidiary in the country that's going to give it the lowest tax bill. And it's quite tricky to say, well, where do we want them to put it? You know, what are we actually asking them to do? If we set rules, then those are the rules that they should be abiding by. Absolutely, it needs to have some commercial reality. And that, to me, is the test. And also, it needs to be transparent, and I think they should be accountable to their shareholders for exactly what it is they're doing. But you do have to have a rule-based system. You can't say to people, to companies, look, you just pay the right amount of tax. And when they say, well, what is the right amount of tax? Well, you should know that. We have got to have rules that companies can abide by.
David, did you want to respond as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to come in on a slightly different angle and just say what the Methodist Tax Justice Network is doing in order to address the issue. I mean, one thing is, I think this is a faith issue. It's a faith and justice issue, profoundly Greenbelt values, if you like. And so the first booklet that we produced was called The Bible and Tax, which looks at how the Bible deals with tax, both in the Old Testament and particularly the New Testament. And you may think that tax collectors get a bad press in the New Testament, which by and large they do, which I think is probably what leads us to think, yeah, tax collectors, the revenue, we don't really like them at all, whereas, of course, the whole system is entirely different now. Taxes in Jesus' time were paid in order to support Herod and his activities, to support the temple and to support the Romans. The ordinary, the little people, going back to that, had three levels of tax to deal with, which laid them out pretty destructively. The second thing that we're doing is to engage with the companies in which the Methodist Church invests, because we've got quite large investments, not as big as the Church of England, but you know, we're chasing them. But actually, we are working with them quite closely on this to raise with the big banks and the big companies, how are you paying your tax? What are you doing? Raising the reputational risk, which Alistair's referred to. And I think it's important to know, for example, that around a quarter of the FTSE top 100 don't pay any corporation tax at all. They find their way around the rules because they help to write them, and therefore they avoid their corporation tax by all kinds of means, which are legitimate, but are they moral? And we're back to that question again. I mean, the third thing that we've done is to just produce a new little pamphlet about the organisations who are trying to address this at international level, and it is complex, as Mike's indicated, but there are things that can be done, the things that you may have heard of, country-by-country reporting by transnationals from the report, the exact business that they do, the profit they make, the taxes they pay in each countries, in each country in which they operate. And there's automatic information exchange between tax authorities in different countries, and there's beneficial ownership. Who owns these trusts in the tax havens where the rich hide, the super rich and the rich hide their money and their other possessions? So we've got that kind of information. And our last little thing is a campaign on Cadbury's, because I'm afraid they've not been paying tax for quite a long time. So we've got our little credit card saying boycott Cadbury's. It's not a financial credit card, it's a moral credit card, but we can supply you with those if you like. And you can even have them if you're not a Methodist. We're very ecumenical about this. So there are a number of kind of things that can be done, and hopefully that'll shift the debate onto what questions people might have.
Thank you. I'm not a definite challenge to boycott Cadbury's. It's tough.
I'm afraid so, until they pay their taxes.
Okay, I'm going to have to write to them about that. I can't handle it. So
lots of fair trade chocolate
lots of fair trade chocolate, yeah. So I'd like to open the questions out to the floor now. I'm sure you've got lots of things you would like to contribute and ask. So there's a couple of people with some mics. We've got a guy at the back in a black top. Are the people with the mics around? Yeah. So can we have, there was a guy at the back in the black top. Can we have your question?
It's just that often complexity is pleaded in relation to tax laws. But if we take somebody like Starbucks, they raise a certain revenue in the UK, and that revenue comes from their coffee shops. And we know what that revenue is, and they should pay the tax that's due on the profits that are generated by that revenue. Now, simply by having an office in Dublin or wherever it is, they avoid that. And the UK government could enforce that. They could say, if you will not pay the revenue on the revenue on the profits that you make from the shops in the UK, we will close the shops in the UK until you pay that revenue. Okay, so very often what you have is a whole establishment that retains complexity rather than going for the radical issues that would actually address the situation and make sure that these 25 massive countries that are evading tax to the level that would sort out George Osborne's sovereign debt problems overnight, if they were really brought into the fold and paid their fair share of taxes, which they haven't been paying for several decades, we could sort this thing out in 6 months.
Would you like to respond, Mike?
Yeah, I've got, in a sense, two responses. One's the technical one. The technical one is that Starbucks do not, at least as it's reported, Starbucks do not make profit in this country. Now, that is surprising, and one can argue about it. But the first point to make is that the figures that tend to be put forward is Starbucks makes X billion pounds worth of sales in the UK and it's paying no tax on it. Well, firstly, that's wrong because it's paying VAT on it, but what it's normally meant is it's paying no corporation tax on it. You don't pay corporation tax on revenue, you pay corporation tax on profits. So the next question is, what profit are they actually making? Obviously, there is a obviously they have expenses, and one of the arguments Starbucks makes, and I do at least to some extent believe this, is that they just bought into leases at the wrong time. They were convinced that we would operate on the American model, where the more Starbucks you had, the more sales you would make, and it didn't matter that they were competing with each other. They bought a whole load of leases that they're now getting out of on Oxford Street, and it really hasn't paid off very well for them. But then you've got the question of, yes, there is a payment that goes out for the royalty. And as I say, actually, there is a real value to the fact that you've got a Starbucks brand. There's an issue about where the coffee beans are roasted, which we won't get into because that really is terribly technical. And then there is a question about where the funding comes from, that they will have a treasury company offshore. And like it or loathe it, that is the way that the government has set the rules. The government has deliberately set the rules so you can have treasury companies offshore and that the funding can come in that way. But can I come back, just sort of to go up a meta level, really. From a faith issue, faith perspective, I've got a bit of a problem with the idea that somehow, if only the big companies would pay their tax, everything would be fine, and therefore I don't have to worry about it. There's just a slight... I worry that we are, you know, standing in the synagogue and saying, Lord, I thank you that I'm not like those other multinationals. And that actually, you know, all have sinned, all have fallen short of the glory of God. There's an issue here about taking personal responsibility. Probably one of the most practical things you can do about tax evasion is the next time that the guy says to you, our shower has just broken, the next time that the guy says to you, that shower, it's 120 quid or 100 quid for cash, you say no. And that actually is something that we should be doing. And there's a narrative beginning which says it's all about the big companies. The big companies' tax has been for many, many years about 10% of the total tax bill, 50% of the total tax we raise. 50% of the tax we raise in the UK comes from income tax and national insurance. You can't actually do much to get in more tax other than put taxes up on individuals. And yes, personally, I am quite in favour of high rates of tax on those who have high incomes. But that is the level of that you need to work at.
Caroline, would you like to feed into the Starbucks question?
That's all right. I suppose something I'd say is that I'm not really interested whether it's, well, I am interested, but I'm also not, whether it's because the government's in conjunction with the accountancy firms, whatever, and the revolving door, which, ooh, I can feel the rage rising in me. Here we go. But I don't really mind whether it's their fault or the multinationals' fault. The problem is the same, and the injustice as a result is the same, and it needs to be tackled. Something that John Christiansen, who was one of the founders of the Tax Justice Network, who I worked on for Islands and this project with as an advisor, is something that he has been campaigning for. Has really been at the forefront of his work recently is a global tax authority, and this feels like something that when he talks about it's fought against by particularly the UK and the US, but it's something where all the different countries, not just the big rich guys who are already in the IMF club, they're all already in the OECD club, it's somewhere where everyone has a voice and where potentially, if that was allowed to exist, things could start to change. Because, yeah, I understand that if the UK government suddenly said, actually, Starbucks, sorry, guys, we're not going to play your game anymore, well, they've got plenty of other places to go. But if there's a sort of global decision, if there is a tax authority which means that we're not relying on sort of the vague goodwill of a particular multinational, and they haven't got any anyway, or a particular government. And yeah, there needs to be the lobbying, but it feels like this global tax authority that John is so passionately campaigning for at the moment feels like a big deal. I don't know. Anyway, I thought I'd throw that in. I'm going to be quiet now.
Thank you. Thank you for that insight. Is there another question from the floor, please? Is another man in black at the front? Yep. Someone's just coming. Okay, we'll come to you afterwards,
yes,
thanks.
Yes, I think I'm right in saying that the 50 or 100 richest people in the world own as much as the 50% of the rest of the world's population. I regard that as a scandal. Jesus would have regarded it as a scandal. What did he say? That when he took the coin, he looked at it and said, pay what you owe to Caesar. Now, the multinational corporations are not doing that. Now, although I think that there's some mileage in trying to put moral pressure on them, as Christian Aid is doing, I don't think that's going to get us all the way. Because at the end of the day, the board of directors of these companies have a duty to get maximum shareholder value. Therefore, the moral pressure will not ultimately get you the whole way. What I think is necessary is for the government. Now, I'm astounded that the big Deloittes and KPMGs are actually inside the government making the tax laws. This is the poachers who with the gamekeepers.
Okay, Mike, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, it should be the government, which should represent us, the people who vote for them, who should be making the laws in favour of the people who vote for them.
Okay.
It should not be unelected private people from the city of London making our tax laws.
Okay, over to you, Mike.
Yeah, I think, let me first talk about the bits where I agree with you, but certainly the large accountancy firms have lobbying power, and their lobbyists will go in and they will argue for things that they want. Frankly, government is perfectly capable of disagreeing. There is, although they have been unfairly cut back, both the revenue and the treasury have some astoundingly good tax brains still within them. Where I have a problem, and it's because I have talked to the people concerned, is with the argument that Margaret Hodge made, that when people were seconded into the treasury, that they went in there to do a job for the accountants, a job for their clients. They did not. They genuinely did not. There is a surprising degree of cooperation between the tax profession and the revenue. And the revenue will tell you, if you ask them, that it cannot work unless there is that level of cooperation. The revenue will also tell you that Margaret Hodge was wrong, and that the two people who went in and worked on the patent box, which was the main problem, were doing what they were asked to do. They genuine, you know, those guys did not put loopholes in the law. They were not in a position to do that, apart from anything else. And I'm not addressing this at you, but at the politicians who did it. It does traduce their reputation and their professionalism to say that they can't go in and do a professional job on the other side of the fence. Just as it's absolutely right that people in the revenue have come out and, having done a very professional job in the revenue, are then doing a professional job for their clients.
Alistair, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, it's just symptomatic of a whole system which is very, very broken and that needs real radical change to make it better. Our tax system was set up in pre-digital age. So we have a tax system which was set up pre-digital in a world that wasn't globalized, that was far smaller at that time. And since that point onwards, as the world has changed, the tax system has just not kept pace by any stretch of the imagination. I think UK tax law now has something like 20,000 pages to it. It's an absolute stack of stuff. So with 20,000 pages, there are going to be loopholes in that, because you've got 20,000 pages worth of law there, which sort of, frankly, anyone who, and in a grudging way, I kind of respect them for going through it and finding those loopholes when you've got 20,000 pages of it. There are loopholes there. And the issue with staff coming in and out of the Treasury and other parts as well is all part of a system that is very broken, that's very challenged. And we need to change that. We really need to change that. And we, all of us in this room, have a responsibility to do so. As citizens, we have a responsibility to hold our government to account. We have a democratically elected government. We have businesses which are actually at times fairly open to receiving sort of letters and so forth. We need to engage with them and push for the changes. We need to push for a global tax body to regulate that, to change that and oversee it. We need to make sure our own government changes its position on that to be more supportive of that. We have seen that success in the last 5 years. Christian Aid, along with the One Campaign and Global Witness, pushed for something called Public Registers of Beneficial Ownership. Not the most exciting name in the world, but essentially what it does was it means that there is now in the UK a register of companies, and it says who owns them, where they're owned, and what for whose benefit they're owned as well. And that's really important in terms of accountability and transparency for clamping down on things called shell companies. Companies that are purely existing to help facilitate tax dodging along the way. And there was a lot of campaigning by many of you, actually, at Greenbelt, the action cards that were taken at Greenbelt 2 years ago. And we saw David Cameron introduce that law. And then Vince Cable, as the business secretary at the time, steer that through Parliament, with it just about gain royal assent a few days before Parliament broke for election. What we need to see now is the government using its influence over the overseas territories in particular, so the likes of the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, for them to do the same. 2 years ago, just before the G8 in Northern Ireland, during the time of the Enough Food for Everyone IF campaign, we saw thousands of people pushing the government to do it, and public pressure was reaching a real high at that point, and it forced the overseas territories, under a fair amount of pressure from the British government as well, to commit with action plans for this and doing public consultations. The overseas territories have dragged their feet to astonishing levels over the last 2 years, with only a few of them completing it, only a few of them saying, well, no, we can't really do this as well. And the governments, the British government, who still holds huge amounts of influence over them, need to start pushing on that as well. But my broader point is, the whole system is very broken. We need to change it. We need to create a tax system fit for the 21st century, rather than a tax system that was based from a sort of a world in the 1920s and 1930s as it is now.
Thanks, Alistair. There was, I think the other microphone's at the back there. Thank you.
My question is really, what can we as individuals do if we own shares in some of these multinational companies? I worked for a company that became part of a large American corporation whose their headquarters in North America, but all their European sales are channeled through Switzerland. They have a president located in Switzerland. The sales force is employed by the Swiss subsidiary, but nothing is made in Switzerland. Hardly anything actually ends up in Switzerland. It covers the whole of the European, Africa, Middle East area, and the whole point of that is to minimize tax. So everything that's made in the UK, everything that's made anywhere else in Europe, is all invoiced to Switzerland, and then Switzerland invoices it out to wherever it's sold. So I'm a shareholder because, you know, I worked for the company for quite a long time. What can people like me do to influence those sort of companies?
That's a great question. David, would you like to respond?
Yes, the first thing you do is make sure you go to the company meeting and raise the questions very directly. I happen to have shares in HSBC and Barclays, Standard Chartered, Shell, one or two more, over from the anti-apartheid days when we used to be doing that, when these companies were involved in apartheid, and it's the same kind of system. And so it's very important to get. That's the one time in the year when you get a chance to face the company board and push them on these questions. You need to do a bit of preparation, a bit of practice. I think Christian Aid are helping to train people in that respect, and there's a Fair Shares at the Fair Shares, join the Fair Share, or the, if you're a pensioner, the Fair Pensions campaign, look them up on the net and you'll find them. Get to the company meetings and confront people vigorously about it, and then ask for a meeting. Please, can we have a meeting with you about this? And it's very difficult for company chairman to refuse to meet shareholders in public, so they'll usually say yes, and then you take it a step further.
Alistair, did you want to say something about that training?
Yes, so we most AGMs tend to happen in spring sort of time, so starting March, April, running through the year. The majority are in London, but there's quite a few that are scattered around the rest of the UK as well, so don't feel that if you're not able to travel to London that it's going to rule you out. There are ones around. Christian Aid tends to run two trainings a year, one in January and then one again in March. One tends to be in person in London, but we also do a conference call one, so you can just call into it from wherever you are. So if people want to get involved with that, just get in contact with us.
That's a great resource to use. Mike?
Just to say, yes, I think one of the most broken things about our economy is shareholders. We are meant to hold companies to account. We're the owners. So I do think we should be doing that. But can I just explain how the system is meant to work? Obviously, I don't know your company. I don't know how it operates. But you can't just make something in the UK and bill it out at cost. You are supposed to sell it on at what is known as a transfer price. Now, everybody has begun to start thinking that transfer pricing is itself a dodge. It's not. It's meant to be the way the system works. I agree with Alistair. It's not working properly. But the way the system is meant to work is that you sell it on from your UK subsidiary to your Swiss subsidiary or Swiss holding company at the market rate. That's what you're meant to be trying to calculate. So that's the way the system's meant to work. The fact that there are problems with it, is definitely there. Personally, I would prefer to try and get that system to work well because I think it could, rather than go for some of the other systems, which I think would be just as difficult.
So can I have another question? This time I'd like to take a question from a woman, please. Thank you. The lady on the front row. Lady on the front row in the blue coat.
Hi. Is anyone actually doing any work, or who is doing work, on a new form of tax system? And can anybody describe the sort of overview of what might it be?
Alistair, is that something that...
The system that's been pushed most of all is something called unitary taxation. And it comes from a sensible idea, which is that what I've just described about transfer pricing works well if you've got a few companies. It doesn't work so well, really, when you've got, you know, a massive multinational with all sorts of things. And part of the problem is that multinationals then create subsidiaries in different places in order to move things to them,
because they think that they can sort of sort through the transfer pricing system that way. So the idea behind unitary taxation is that you work out the global profits of your multinational and you then allocate them between countries on some basis. Alice is possibly going to help me. The three factors that people are normally talking about: one is assets, one is payroll, and the other is workers, isn't it? Now, that sounds great, and as a conceptually as a system, that's not a bad idea. The trouble is, I know exactly what will happen if we do it, which is that all of a sudden you will no longer have workers in a subsidiary in a country that's got a high tax rate. You'll have outsourced it to somebody who's technically independent, so that you haven't got any workers anymore. In other words, I personally think the unitary tax system is just as easily dodged as the one that we've got at the moment, and at least the one that we've got at the moment, we know where some of the problems are. And at the moment, the work that's being done on base erosion and profit shifting, which you'll see, if you see the acronym BEPS, that's what that's about. The OECD is doing a lot of work on it. I do agree that one of the problems with that is that it is the large countries that are getting the biggest say rather than the smaller ones.
David, is there? Would you like to?
Just a brief addition. I mean, I think as been said earlier, the Tax Justice Network, I mean, Google them, look at them, they are the gurus in all of this. And yes, we do need a global system in the end. But in the meantime, in the interim, the EU is trying to work on this, and the OECD. We got, you know, bits of information about them in this new leaflet. And in particular, the EU is trying to develop something called a Common Corporate Consolidated Tax Base, CCTB, which, you know, the jargon again. But our government is the one that's opposing this. Most of the other EU want to go ahead with it with a consolidated tax system. The UK does not. So again, we have to get onto our government and say this is not acceptable.
I just wondered, Caroline and Omar, seeing as you, with your show, you were thinking about the big epic themes, did you imagine a new way to do tax as you were working on the show?
We are mainly just shouting abuse at the current system.
And that's fine. That's fine.
But that the book that you mentioned earlier, so Treasure Islands, I should have mentioned that earlier, because that was the one that when I was doing my early research and swimming in the muddy, boring puddles of statistics and going, and my dad's an accountant, and he said to me, "You're making a show about tax. How are you going to make that interesting?" And then he left the kitchen, he looked really horrified, and then he popped his head back in and went, "Have you thought about music?" That was it. So, but Treasure Islands is an incredible book, and if you haven't read it, it's such an easy read as well. Like, I've read it about four times. I'm still grasping some of it. This stuff just slips from heads that aren't trained in it, I think. But the end of that book talks about ideas about possibilities for the future, and the Tax Justice Network also has a regular blog where their current campaigns are up there. So yeah, I just sort of echo that Tax Justice Network.
And who was the writer of Treasure
Island? Nick Jackson. But John Christensen helped him write it, so it's very much John's voice as well.
Okay, can I have this lady on the front in the blue top, the blue and the white coat?
This is really for Omar and Caroline. I understand that you're trying to bring together theatre of the grotesque and a huge social justice issue, which I think is probably quite a rare thing to merge those two forms. I'm really interested to understand what you hope your audience's response is and who you hope is watching both Islands and this piece. Do you hope that these big multinational corporations will have individuals sitting in the audience who work for them? Or is it more a platform for you to share your rage?
You start. Oh, shall I start? We played at the Bush Theatre. We opened at the Bush Theatre in London, and we had a 5-week run, like a big, normal, serious production in a respectable new writing venue. So we had a quite average crowd in terms of the representation. The Bush is in Shepherd's Bush, which sits between White City Estate, one of the most deprived areas of the country, apparently, and Holland Park, where houses go for 2.5 million plus. And amongst the audience and even the donors and supporters of the Bush, of course, there are lots of people who even have money and trusts in secrecy jurisdictions, whether it's the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Jersey. So a lot of the people were there. And a lot of people, I think, also demonstrated what they thought about the piece. We had people walking out after 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, at different stages. But I think that was exactly what we were expecting. A lot of people stayed and stayed until the end to watch the piece and say, I disagree completely with this. And a lot of people saw it and said, I didn't like it, but I thought it was necessary. So the amount of responses that we've had has covered a bit the whole spectrum of possible reactions. I guess as artists, you always want to put your piece of work in front of as many people possible to gauge as many reactions possible. I think what we were very keen on not doing was just preach to the converted and, you know, and then have a drink in the bar, you know, patting ourselves on how good we were at shouting off at the powerful and the wealthy. I think what we spoke a bit about this piece in terms of power, and I think it is really about readdressing a bit what is the relationships of power, and that's why we chose a style that was very confrontational. I guess with this piece, it's more Caroline speaking to you. With Islands, you're a bit more hijacked by a gang of people for an hour and a half, so it's slightly more terrible as an experience for an audience member. But I guess it's that terrifying experience that needs to be had. And some people are really excited about having it because they feel that same amount of rage and anger and hate towards this level of inequality. Some other people just brush it off as a bunch of turns doing their thing on stage and not being very good at it. And that's absolutely fine. I think I've always felt very proud about the mixed responses that we had for this piece. It meant that we were doing the right thing. Rather than just a pleasing or informative thing. Does that answer the question?
If we've got time. Did you want to say anything else, Caroline?
That was good.
Okay, so they've got time for probably one or two other questions. This guy with the yellow lanyard around his neck in the middle.
Yellow lanyard? No.
Yep, yeah. Keep your hand up. Yep.
I won't. Caroline and Omar, you made a presumably conscious decision to make a show that was quite static visually, but quite busy for the audio. And you're quite low on the stage. So that's a sort of technical choice. Why did you choose to do that rather than use the space, move it around, use different levels, I don't know, so on and so forth? Because I think that if you had people walking out, is it perhaps because of the way you chose to do something static rather than something that was more using the space and using different levels and so on?
The one that everyone leaves is the one with five, not everyone, some people leave. We just did it at Edinburgh at the British Council Showcase, and I think in eight shows we only had two leave. We're not doing it right anymore. No, it's joking. I much prefer people to stay and watch. I'm of course I do. But the one that Omar was talking about, the Bush, wasn't this one. This version is very new. So we've done it here and at Latitude, and I mean, I'm sure some people leave, but generally people have stayed. It's much, much less difficult for an audience than islands, where you've got these five beasts like circulating, and we move in islands. I can feel, I've just finished on Saturday and I know I move because the way my body feels. But I think in terms of the difference between the two pieces, what I was interested in with this one, in islands, we have these five have-nots who greet the audience, and they look foul. Huh? Like, I've got testicles on the outside of my costume with silver glitter on, and these big ugly boobs and a helmet, and everyone else is basically their own version of this. And they say, okay, we're going to play a game. We're going to be the gods. And is everyone okay with that? All okay? Great. And they keep doing this. So they keep pushing their game further and further. And they set the rules. And they are nasty. And they have a lot of fun. And sometimes we all have fun together. So it gets a bit complicated for the audience. So it's like, oh, I quite enjoyed that last bit. Whoops. And so that's the relationship. And that's super uncomfortable, I think. And deliberately so. I mean, it's very playful, but it's hard too. But with this one, we wanted to tell sort of the other side of the story, because in that one, two of the have-nots play Adam and Eve, and they get Eve gets chucked out or leaves, a bit of both, and because she rebels, she's the whistleblower. And so with this, it was an opportunity to sort of tell Eve's story from when she's landed back down in the shit, on shit world. And so that's why she's stuck. It's because we took that story and sort of upended it. So we're, rather than shouting down, as we do in islands, we have this drain that they shout down. Now Eve's on the floor shouting up, and she's pretty stuck in the mud. So, et voilà.
We should go and see islands as well then, so we get the other side of it. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question to panel on a slightly different topic about land value tax? Because one of the reasons that we're having such difficulty in collecting taxes because it escaped out of this country, but one thing that's very difficult to move or hide is land. There's a big difference between income inequality and wealth inequality. You think, well, income inequality is bad, you should look at wealth inequality. And land is one of the biggest sources of wealth and one of the easiest to tax, in that you can't move it abroad. So I wondered, had the panel, any of you advocated for land value taxation? And if so, what headway have you found?
Alistair, is that an area that you've worked in at all?
I'd just say it's a very good idea, but it's going to take a lot of hard work.
It's something we've discussed, albeit sort of discussed in the office and occasionally with my policy colleagues around looking at it, picking up on what we were talking about before around changing the tax system and unitary taxation and so forth. It's how we unwind all of this. So sort of, I think it's something that's really important. I think it should be something that's considered in sort of when we look at unitary taxation in more detail. I know Alex Cobham, who heads up the research Tax Justice Network, has been looking at it quite a lot. So I think it's an area we can explore more.
I don't believe in any sort of panacea. Land value tax has been a traditional, I use the word advisedly, traditional liberal policy for a long time. And it's got a lot of advantages. There is an issue about the fact that you're not then taxing the value of the massive building that you've put on the land. And there's also a problem that if you have, let's say, for example, a house that's empty, you're going to have land value tax that has to be paid on it. But I do agree with the idea that taxing land is a good idea. Can I also add the one thing which I really think should be taxed quite heavily and hasn't been for some considerable time, although it used to be, is inheritances. The very time that it's economically literate to take money out of the system is when somebody who has died, who very clearly doesn't need it anymore, and the person who's going to get it hasn't yet had it. But we have a great aversion to inheritance tax in this country.
So just as we come to a close, I wanted to ask the panel one last thing. I'm sure there's people who are sitting there, and maybe me as well, just who have got their blood boiling at the moment, and they're filled with the rage. So tomorrow when I wake up and my blood's still boiling, what shall I do? So I'd like to ask each of the panel to respond to that. Just a minute's response to what can I do tomorrow if my blood's boiling about this issue?
Log on to Christian Aid's website, read up about the issue, read Nick Shaxton's book, and get active campaigning. Really do that. If you own shares, get in contact with us, get trained up, go to an AGM. If you don't, get in contact with your MP, write to them about the issues. Christian Aid's website's full of useful resources to help you and support you on that. And my team's there to help you as well, so just give us a ring if you want more information.
I would say read widely. Certainly read the stuff that Christian Aid puts out, that Action Aid puts out, but read more widely than that. I would say if you are looking to support businesses which do pay their taxes, look out for, and you won't find many of them yet, but look out for a business that has the fair trade, the fair tax mark. Because that is an initiative which I think is well worthwhile. It's not an absolute guarantee, but it's a fair guarantee that they have got the right policies in place and that they are not doing anything wrong with tax. So look out for the fair tax mark, and they have a website, the address of which I forget, but if you look up fair tax mark, you'll find it.
Yes, that's a part of Tax Research, which is a parallel group to Tax Justice Network, which Richard Murphy, who I'm glad to know, is advising Jeremy Corbyn in his campaign at the moment, which is quite an interesting one, and that's something that might change the political climate somewhat. That's a slightly different issue. We've got some of our literature here. My colleague Matt's around at the back somewhere, so you can start your studying here. But as Alistair says, get to know the issues. Find which is the particular thing that you want to get your teeth into, and get your teeth into it. This is a long haul. You know, we're in this for 10 years. It's going to take that long to shift the system. But if we all push together, we can do it.
I suppose I'd say similar. The things that I, as someone who hadn't really engaged with this stuff at all, the things that fired me up and I found really informative and inspiring were the work of UK Uncut, the Treasure Islands book, and also a brilliant film, whose name I'm now going to forget, but it's by a filmmaker called Mark Dunn, The UK Gold, which is very interesting about the particular city of London on this issue. But I think, UK Uncut are completely brilliant as well.
Last recommendation, a little bit of pressure. I don't know, for anything that makes me passionate, I start with a conversation. I guess I start speaking with other people about it. I want to understand if they know as much as I do or as little as I do, and where can I get informed a bit more, and where can I meet similarly minded people or people who think it completely different from what I think, and how I can challenge my knowledge. And then a lot of the time that translates maybe in a show, maybe in a movie, maybe in a book, or maybe just in a group of people doing a class action. But I think that first spark of wanting to confront with other people about it and really speaking it already makes the issue alive, rather than just sitting home on the toilet with the head on my hands thinking what I'm going to do about the world.
Thank you all. We're certainly not powerless. So thank you, everyone, for your recommendations. And thank you, everyone, for coming and for asking your questions. I'm sorry for those people who didn't get to ask their questions this time. But thank you very much to the panel and for your show, which was wonderful. So if we can just show our appreciation by...